German goalkeeper who did a brutal foul in the semi-final against France. Oh, so Zoe's better than that.
She's got to be. So, Shuey Gallagher or Schumacher, Steve? You decide.
Shuey Gallagher.
Shuey Gallagher it is. Zoe, from now on, you are Shuey Gallagher. Hey, thanks, Steve. Hugh, we can't thank you enough. Come back anytime soon.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. The Prime Minister will warn of a shared struggle ahead, but say there is light at the end of the tunnel in a key speech to Labour Party delegates today. In his first address at conference since taking office, Sir Keir Starmer will say tough decisions need to be taken to build a new Britain. Following weeks of criticism over cuts to winter fuel payments and donation transparency, activists in Liverpool told the BBC what they'd like to hear from the Prime Minister.
We've heard a lot about the deficit and the big black hole, but what we want to hear is, what are we going to do about it?
I'd like him to be much more optimistic. People have been in the realm of 14 years of complete devastation with no hope, not being able to put food on the table. So it's about giving people hope.
People in southern Lebanon have been fleeing their homes en masse after extensive Israeli airstrikes. The Lebanese Health Ministry said nearly 500 people had been killed in cross-border fire. The Israeli military said it hit around 1,300 Hezbollah targets. The White House has said that President Biden will present concrete plans for ending the crisis in Lebanon at the UN General Assembly this week. The EU's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell, has been speaking at a news conference in New York.
The civilians are paying a high price in almost a full-blown war, which must be averted, including by renewing intense diplomatic mediation efforts. And here in New York is the moment to do that. Everybody has to put all their capacity to stop this path to war.
A ban on zombie-style knives and machetes has come into force in England and Wales. A four-week amnesty, which allowed people to hand in knives to the police without prosecution, has ended. It's now illegal to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives, often used by criminal gangs. The number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police forces rose significantly in the 12 months to August. 27 out of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association. More than 900 illegal e-bikes were seized, compared to 511 for the previous 12 months. A new research has found that octopuses sometimes form hunting packs with fish, working together to catch prey. It's believed the arrangements benefit both creatures, with the fish scouting out potential prey and then calling on the octopus to use its long arms to capture it. But as Alfie Tobit reports, octopuses don't always play nicely.
Researchers found they work together with different species of fish when hunting for prey, even making decisions on behalf of the pack and sharing leadership responsibilities. But things don't always go swimmingly. Scientists witnessed octopuses punching fish in the group, apparently as a way of making them work harder and keeping them on task. The authors of the study say it shows that when it comes to sentience, octopuses are closer to humans than previously thought.
BBC News, it's 3 minutes past four.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Dotun Adebayo. BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, good morning. This is The Nightclub. I'm your night watchman. You've missed the World Football phone-in, but that's okay, because you can listen again on BBC Sounds, and it was a cracker. We actually drew a map, a football map of Britain. That's worth hearing, I'm sure. But you can also hear other great things on BBC Sounds, like Newscast, the podcast. Here's the latest episode with Adam and the team.
This episode of Newscast is coming to you, I was going to say live, but it's not live, because podcasts can't be live because the medium wouldn't allow it, from Labour Party conference in Liverpool. Have you guys seen any celebrities, Alex and Chris?
Do you count MPs as celebrities if they're quite well known?
Yeah.
Then yeah.
Most of the cabinet.
That's the good thing about these events, because they are just sort of wandering around.
Just floating around the place.
At one point, Keir Starmer came into our office for about 20 minutes.
He did. So I was aware he was coming. I was hiding, not because he was coming, but I was hiding
done any negative stories that he might have...
I was in the car park in a kind of shed thing, which is where we do our TV editing. And so I didn't get to see him, but I was aware he was
there. And I rather rudely, as he came in, rushed past him and went, oh, sorry, I've got to get by to go and do...
I'm out the way. I'm busy, don't you know?
But in terms of actual celebrities, lots of people have seen Gary Neville.
Yes.
Oh.
Apparently, David James, the former England goalkeeper, was here as well.
I spotted him.
It was him.
Because of my completely inadequate sporting knowledge, I didn't dare... say it was him in case I just looked like an idiot.
I think he's been at party conferences before, come to think of it. And then Gary, I'm not sure about David James's politics, but Gary Neville is very much a Labour enthusiast, isn't
he? We did a party election broadcast on him, didn't he?
Yeah.
My favourite celebrity spot, are you Lord of the Rings fans?
Yes. The books and the films.
So J.R.R. Tolkien wasn't here. Andy Serkis, who played Gollum, was there.
No.
Yeah, I just happened to bump into him, and he was here lobbying for a tax credit for visual effects.
That's a pretty good celeb spot. Yeah.
And in terms of my best political celeb spot, I did spend about 20 minutes sat in this very table with Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, after her speech. So you'll hear a lot of that in this episode of Newscast.
Newscast.
Newscast from the BBC.
The exit poll is predicting a Labour landslide.
We did it!
And before you know it, you have a bright future behind you.
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence.
Joe, you did such a great job. You answered every question.
Take me down to Downing Street. Let's go have a tour.
Blimey.
Hello, it's Adam at the Labour Party conference.
Hello, it's Alex also at the Labour Party conference.
And Chris. Also at the Labour Party conference.
And we should say thank you to Joe Coburn from Politics Live for lending us the Politics Live set to sit on.
This is quite
the seats
isn't
are quite
it?
High. I don't think my feet touch the ground.
No, mine
don't. Dangling in child fashion.
Joko Land is quite glitzy, isn't it? And bright lights and all that.
Anyway, so let's go on to the news. Does seem to me the whole donations... people getting their glasses paid for by peers, Sue Gray getting paid more than the Prime Minister. That seems to have kind of, that's been dialed down a bit, that story.
Yeah, go for it, Chris.
I rather than saying bean dada, it's sort of, it has dialed down, I should say.
Yeah, I think it has dialed down because there's other stuff that's being said that is more newsworthy now, and that's kind of how news works, doesn't it, really? And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily resolved, at least the Sue Gray element of it. I'll be intrigued to see if she is on the plane to the United Nations General Assembly, which the Prime Minister is heading to in New York tomorrow night, Tuesday night, after his speech. But, you know, a Chancellor's speech at a party conference, even if it isn't packed with wildly new stuff, is still a thing, isn't it? And they have tried to sort of answer all that clothing stuff by saying, well, they won't take any more. So, yeah, if yesterday was kind of quite a bit about that, then today's been quite a bit about her, hasn't it? About the Chancellor.
We'll come on to Rachel Reeves in a minute. But, Alex, you've been here since Saturday.
You've
basically been on the news channel constantly since Saturday morning. And your live spot is out in the corridor where basically everyone who comes into the conference has to go past you. So it's probably quite a good place to sort of survey people about how they feel the last few weeks or the first few months of the Labour government have been going.
Yeah, well, back to the point about the whole freebies row, because I have stood there pretty much since Saturday lunchtime. That was still bubbling among the kind of mood of conference. And there are obviously some people that think it's all a bit of an unnecessary distraction and something that journalists just want to get their teeth into. And then there are other people who just think these are like unnecessary self-inflicted wobbles quite early on in a term. But weirdly today, even among the people I was just catching and chatting to and getting a sense from, the focus had shifted onto the bigger kind of economic picture and Labour's policy and Labour's direction. And I think there is a sense, you know, there's definitely a kind of like sense of celebration here that this is the first conference for Labour in power in 15 years and the first one with a Labour Prime Minister in 14 years and all of that. There's definitely a sense of it, but I would also say the stuff of last week around the freebies, the briefings around Sue Gray, and then some really important policy things like the winter fuel payment have made this a bit more wobbly than Labour would have liked in terms of its first conference in office, and you're getting a sense of that from the people that I've been chatting to through the day.
Yeah, I think when I contrast it with a year ago, so last year's Labour conference in this exact same venue, and by the way, they're going to be here for plenty more years to come.
Oh, are they? They don't have five for the price of four.
It might even be more than that, right, actually, in terms of, and this is the third year in a row, I think. I think it was Brighton in 2001, and it's been Liverpool ever since. Anyway, last year, this conference was heaped with kind of excitement and expectation. Yes, an awareness that at that point they hadn't won anything in terms of the general election, but the hope that that was just round the corner. This year, I think there's the weight of government, there's the difficulty of trade-offs and choices, and, you know, you hear the anger from some on the left, the trade unions and others who, you know, think there's been some missteps around, for instance, the winter fuel payment.
And there's been a processy thing there, isn't there, that was meant to be a vote about it amongst the delegates on today, but it's been shifted back to Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah, and whatever comes of that, the government will carry on regardless. And then there's been this sort of stuff around freebies and Tugay, the Prime Minister's chief of staff and all that. I was talking to a cabinet minister earlier, though, who said, you know, and they're trying to give it the best spin, I suppose, but saying that they were reassured that what they thought of as the fundamentals were sound. And by that, they meant the Prime Minister and the Chancellor get on, which hasn't always been the case in various governments of the past, and that they thought that the government was basically functioning, that the Prime Minister was on board with what the major government departments are doing. Now, there's some arguing, and you get this in every government, there's some arguing privately that the centre is still a bit sticky. The stuff goes into Downing Street for sign-off and doesn't come out quickly enough. As I say, you kind of do get that all the time, though. So it's just an interesting kind of reflection. But, yeah, I think they'll be glad they've sort of parked that other stuff, at least for now.
I think there's definitely a sense of they realise it's different now, you know, now that they're in government. And that might be a statement of the obvious, but, like, even the kind of delegates and members and activists who come year after year after year, they feel that it's different, and it's like reality setting in. And that's not to say that they didn't expect it and obviously weren't aware of what was coming, but the reality of it is here now, and I feel like it has kind of hit them and it's changed the feel and the tone of the whole thing.
Yeah, because the kind of binding agent of a desire to win has gone because they have won. And now it's about arguments about policies and ideas, and with that, trade-offs and choices, and, oh, well, if we do X, can we do Y, and all of that kind of stuff. And that's difficult, but then that's also a privilege if you're in government.
Right, let's talk about Rachel Reeves' speech, which was at lunchtime on Monday. Chris has got a copy of it printed off there. I remember in the old days they used to sell them for money to raise party funds.
Maybe you can make some funds in the future.
Yeah, I remember when Ed Miliband in 20... What month in the year was the 2015 election?
May.
Can't remember.
May. The standard election.
Yeah, it was the 2014 Labour conference, I think, when Ed Miliband did a no notes thing and managed to forget
the deficit. Which was the main public policy issue.
And then the morning after, Labour students who would try and make money out of flogging printed copies of the speech are then flogging copies of the printed speech that he'd not used.
That had the deficit bit in it. Yeah, so it actually was a genuine historical document.
The segment that he hadn't read out.
And then do you remember when Jeremy Corbyn, his first speech as leader, and he read out the stage directions and he said, strong message here. And that will not stand. Anyway, so with Rachel Reeves' speech, I think there were kind of two big constraints for her going into this. One, she couldn't be too miserable because they've decided that they have been miserable enough for the last couple of months and actually they need to be a little bit more optimistic and a little more like sunshiny. And second of all, she's got a budget on the 30th of October, which is actually when she unveils all her thinking and all her decisions. So she was a little bit constrained in what she could announce today. And normally they like to announce big stuff in these speeches to make sure it goes with a bang.
Yeah, I felt like she was really kind of walking the line between maintaining the rhetoric that we've heard from her before about, I'm going to be careful with your money, I'm not going to pay fast and loose with public money, you can trust Labour with your money, and at the same time trying to sound a bit more sunny. And not just because I think people want a bit of optimism, but also because there has been this kind of train of thought which says if you're too gloomy it dents consumer confidence and it might potentially dent business investment. So there's potentially a real, so I felt like she was straddling the two in tone, definitely leaning towards the more hopeful in the long term, but effectively trying to, I think, tell people why they are doing what they were doing. I think it was an attempt to clarify a bit more and be, you know, a bit more straight with the narrative around the economic pain or tough choices, as they like to call it.
And I think a recognition of the reality that when you're in government, words really matter. And if you use loads of words that add up to a sentiment of gloom, then the danger is, and that this is a concern that senior folk have had privately, that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, that you talk the economy down. I mean, we talk the economy into a recession. So whilst they want to maintain this idea that, as they think it, they're being honest about the difficult choices, they don't want to... They accuse the previous government of sort of celebrating every micro win, and then people are looking in thinking, yeah, but life's not great.
Yeah.
They don't want to be quite as gloomy in their choice of adjectives about the economy. whilst at the same time trying to do that thing, as you were saying, Alex, of Rachel Reeves making the case that she is a careful custodian of the economy. But the challenge she's going to face in the next couple of years is that that'll just become a baseline, a kind of expectation. And actually, you've got to build stuff upon that that is seen as a dividend, that's seen as a win, that's seen as a thing beyond an absence of economic chaos.
Right, let's listen to the conversation I then had with Rachel Reeves. So her morning went like this. She did loads of interviews on the media previewing her speech.
16, I think, this morning.
There you go, that's a lot of interviews. And she's very good at sticking to a script, so I think she will not have deviated 16 times. Then she did the speech. It got interrupted by a couple of times by hecklers, one of whom was like kind of ushered out quite dramatically by security. Then she went off and had a leftover sandwich for lunch. Then she was going to get ready to go and speak to some business people.
Leftover by who? Hang on.
By her. It was like a half-eaten sandwich from... Anyway, and then but in the middle of all that, she came and sat down and chatted to me. And here's what our conversation was like. Chancellor, hello.
Hello, great to be with you.
Lovely to see you. It's such a loud... This the thing about Labour conferences, it's always very loud.
Well,
so we're going to be shouting at each other.
This year it's louder than ever. I mean, that's what being in government does. But I've been coming to these conferences since the late 1990s when Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were in power, and for the last 14 years I've been coming along whilst we've been in opposition, and the atmosphere this year, the Labour conference with a Labour government, it really is electric.
And there was a big bit in your speech about being the first female Chancellor in 800 years. I'm just wondering, like last night, did you sleep well? Were you nervous? Were you excited? What was it like?
Those lines, they meant a lot to me. And I know they mean a lot to a lot of women. After I gave the speech and I was walking back through the exhibition area where we are now, so many women stopped me and said, I'm going to show that speech to my daughter, or I'm going to show that speech to my granddaughter and show them that they can achieve anything they want to achieve. And I think that line where I said, for our daughters and granddaughters, there should be no ceiling on their ambition. I think that is something that still resonates for so many women. And again, a lot of women were saying, when I started my career, I was one woman. When I started my career, I was the first woman in the office to wear a trouser suit. And she said, I know it sounds like a small thing, but things have changed so much. And seeing you become Chancellor shows that journey continues.
And of course, when you talk about being the first female Chancellor, then people, the follow-up to that is, do you fancy being the first Labour female Prime Minister?
The job I've always wanted to do is Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think I've probably told you this story before about when I was at university, one of my good friends, Helen, got me a picture for my birthday of Gordon Brown in a frame and put it on my my mantelpiece in my student halls of residence. So I think ever since then, this is my dream job. I worked in economics and finance before becoming a Member of Parliament, and for me this is my dream come true, to be able to stand here as the first Labour Chancellor in 14 years and the first ever female Chancellor of the Exchequer.
And if you've gone out and bought a picture of Rachel Reeves for your mantelpiece, do let us know. Newscast at bbc.co.uk. We'll let you know if anyone gets in touch. Anyway, we'll talk about the content of the speech loads, I promise. But just in terms of the delivery, you had a couple of protesters and hecklers. What goes through your mind when you see the random guy standing up trying to have a go at you?
Well, obviously, I sort of flashback to last year at conference when someone got on the stage and glitter-bombed Keir. Actually, it was the making of his speech, and he took his jacket off and rolled his sleeves up. But, you know, we plan for these speeches. They're big moments for us. I put my heart into it. Of course, you don't want it interrupted by some protester. But Labour conference, the hall came together and got to its feet to drown out the noise of the protesters. And the staff here at our conference did a really good job of getting them out of the hall, because that's not the moment for that sort of protest. I'm always willing to listen to people who don't agree with me on something. But this is a moment at our conference to get across that positive message from Britain. Oh, so, I didn't want to be interrupted
by that. So protesters should not do that, even though they've got the right to protest and the right to free speech,
and
just not in that way.
I don't think so. I don't think that is appropriate. And you saw the mood in conference was very much against that. They wanted to hear from the first Labour Chancellor in 14 years. This is an exciting moment for our conference. We want to celebrate. Yes, of course, there's going to be difficult decisions. We're not always going to agree. But that's what the debate is for at conference. You know, you'll hear the debate on conference floor, and everyone's going to be agreeing with each other, and nor should they. But that is the way to make your view known in a democratic party, which is what the Labour Party is, not through that sort of protest.
The other thing that happened during your speech was the Royal College of Nursing saying that their members had voted to reject the 5.5% pay increase. When did you hear about that? Did you know before you went on stage that that's what they were going to do?
No, I didn't. And I do understand why nurses, after 14 years of pay not keeping up with the rising cost of living, that they feel that their finances are still very stretched. I hope they also see, though, that in a difficult economic situation, a difficult fiscal position, I accepted the recommendations of the independent pay review bodies to give the first meaningful real terms pay increase to nurses and other public sector workers in 14 years. I was really proud to make that choice. It's not an easy choice given the difficult economic circumstances, but I thought it was the right thing to do to accept those recommendations. And I know that Wes Streeting, our health secretary, wants to work with our nurses to ensure that they are properly respected and treated well. I think it was a good offer that we put to them, and I hope we can work through this.
Does this not show the danger of, if you give junior doctors a much higher pay increase than nurses are going to be really angry?
Well, look, we wanted to bring an end to the industrial action, which cost patients dearly, so many cancelled appointments and operations, but also cost our economy dearly and had a big impact on our public finances. The cost of industrial action last year alone in the NHS cost us £1.8 billion. We needed to bring to an end that industrial action and give people the treatment in the NHS that they need and deserve. And I don't think nurses and doctors begrudge each other getting a pay rise. We accepted the independent pay review body recommendations, not just for the NHS, but also for our teachers, our armed forces, our police, our prison officers and many more, because I felt it was the right thing to do to bring an end to that industrial action, to help with the recruitment and retention problem, and to ensure that kids get a good education, patients get a decent service in our National Health Service.
Just another little conference process thing. Was there meant to be a vote today on a motion that included some criticism about means testing the winter fuel payment? And that debate's now been shunted back to Wednesday. So a big distance away from your speech. Is that you trying to kind of shut down debate about that?
No, I'm not involved in those sorts of decisions. That's Conference Arrangements Committee, which is elected by members of the party to choose that committee. But this is a democratic party. If members want to vote on something, they'll be able to have a vote on it, and it will come at some point this week. I think you heard in conference today that although not everyone might agree with every decision I make, there was a respect for the fact that for the first time in a long time, you've got a government that's being honest about the scale of the challenges in the public finances. And although people might not agree with every decision I make, they recognise that I'm trying to do the right thing in very difficult circumstances.
And if whenever that vote happens, conference says, yeah, we're not happy with the winter fuel payment being means tested, what, you just ignore them?
Well, look, let's see what happens in the vote whenever that comes this week. But Parliament has already voted. Parliament voted a few weeks ago to means test the winter fuel payment. So the poorest pensioners, those on pension credit, will continue to get it. And, of course, we've recommitted to the triple lock, not just for 1 year, but for the duration of this Parliament. The triple lock means that pensions are £900 more than they were a year ago. I'll announce in the budget that the new state pension will rise by around £460 again next year. And over the duration of this Parliament, the new state pension is likely to rise by £1,700. So we're protecting the incomes of pensioners. But in the difficult circumstances we've inherited, we've chosen to restrict winter fuel payment for those pensioners most in need.
Right. Loads of things I could ask you about the speech, and I'll sort of rattle through as many as we can in the time we've got. Bringing forward the rollout of the free breakfast breakfast clubs in England. You said it would be hundreds of schools from next April. Is that kind of like 200 or 900?
Well, we're going to work with schools to see which ones have capacity and desire to bring those forward. We also think it will help with the national rollout from next September to allow some schools to go first and to trial it and make sure that it works really well in making sure that every good child gets a really good start to the day. It will be part of our strategy to reduce child poverty and also a boost to our economy. We want to get economic inactivity down. We want more people to be working and working the hours that they want. And free breakfast clubs at primary schools, that gives parents, and particularly mums, because it is still mums who do the majority of childcare in our country, will enable them to work a little bit more, have more money in their pockets to support themselves and their families. So I was really pleased to be able to work with Bridget Phillipson to bring forward the rollout of those breakfast clubs.
Okay. When you talk about working class kids having richer lives, what do you mean?
This is something that I'm absolutely passionate about. My mum and dad were primary school teachers. I went to my local comprehensive during the 80s and 90s, and it was a time when there were cuts in education. My mum was a special needs teacher, but then special needs funding was cut, and so my mum became a classroom teacher. That meant a lot of kids that were getting support from people like my mum no longer did. And I see today, after 14 years of Conservative government, things like music in schools, drama in schools, sports in schools, all cut to the bone. So kids from more privileged backgrounds whose parents can afford the tuition, can afford the classes at weekends and after school, they still get those opportunities, but working class kids don't. And it makes me so angry that kids are being denied those opportunities. So that's what I mean about kids being able to realise their potential. The joy of learning a sport, learning a musical instrument, shouldn't it be preserved of better off kids from better off families? I want all kids to be able to achieve their potential, realise their dreams. I had a line in my speech about kids shouldn't be succeeding against the odds. The odds shouldn't be stacked against working class kids. And that's what I mean by expanding opportunity and ensuring that I know my time in office has been a success if there are more kids from ordinary working class backgrounds being able to live those richer, more fulfilled lives and able to thrive.
There was also a line in your speech, and I did have it open on my laptop, but it's gone to sleep now. Classic. About getting the Treasury to change how it values public investments. So it's not just looking at the costs. Tell me a bit more about what you're getting at there. And that could sound quite technical, so don't make it too techie, please.
I'm sure you can manage it, Adam. So under the previous government, their fiscal rules didn't differentiate between spending on day-to-day things, whether those are wages or the day-to-day costs of running public services.
Yeah, current spending, that's called current spending.
They didn't differentiate between that and capital spending, which has a long-term return for our country. And as a result, when there were difficult decisions to be made, the previous government always cut capital spending, which meant it was harder then to grow our economy because we weren't investing in the infrastructure, the new technologies, the new investment opportunities. And so the fiscal rules that I have committed us to in our manifesto and we'll set out in the budget does differentiate between the two. We will make the difficult decisions to balance day-to-day spending with tax receipts. We're going to get debt down as a share of our GDP, but subject to that, we will free up that space for investment in capital. And the point that I'm making is about the Treasury and government looking at the value of investment, not just the cost of it, because actually the cost of inaction, the cost of missing out on those investment opportunities is missed economic growth, missed jobs, missed opportunities, missed wealth creation in Britain. And our number one mission, this new Labour government's number one mission, is to grow our economy. And the way to grow the economy is through investment, public and private, working together to unlock the massive opportunities that
exist. Just to be clear, though, then, so your second fiscal role in the budget, will it still be debt as a share of GDP decreasing at the end of 5 years, using the same measure of debt as we use now and the same 5 years that we've been talking about for the last few years?
We'll set out the details at the budget, but in our manifesto, we committed to balance day-to-day spending with tax receipts and get debt down as a share of GDP within a five-year period. We're not going to renege on our manifesto commitments. We're really clear. And I said in my speech, you know,
I don't see how that leaves you any room then. to do anything differently?
Well, look, we'll set out the precise details in the manifesto. Our fiscal rules are already different from the previous government in that day-to-day spending and capital investment are treated differently.
Yeah, that doesn't matter if you've still got the second fiscal rule about debt falling. That's the big constraint on you at the end of 5 years.
And it shows how important it is to get a grip of the day-to-day spending, because unless you do that, you won't be able to free up that investment. But I'm not going to make those short-term decisions that the previous Conservative government did, which was always to cut capital spending to make the sums add up. If you do that, you'll find at the next budget and the next spending review, the trade-offs are even harder than they were before. So we will properly incentivize that investment in infrastructure and also leveraging in private investment. That's why we've created a National Wealth Fund. The work that Mark Carney did for the Labour Party in opposition of how to structure the National Wealth Fund to leverage in £3 of private investment for every pound of public investment putting in. So that's about getting good returns for taxpayers' money by bringing in that private investment as well, whether it's in industries like carbon capture and storage, green hydrogen, floating offshore wind, gigafactories for electric vehicles. There's lots of money out there to be invested. I want that investment. I want those jobs to come to Britain, and under our plans, with our National Wealth Fund, our planning reforms, our pensions reform, I am confident that we can get that investment, get those jobs here in the UK.
Couple of bits of speculation. Are you thinking about getting rid of the single person's discount for council tax?
Look, I'm not going to get into speculation on individual measures in the budget, but I was really clear in the manifesto. I recognise that working people have faced for too long deteriorating living standards, because every time there were taxes to be raised, the Conservatives piled those taxes on working people. I don't want to be that sort of government.
Sounds like you're not going to do that then. The freeze on the income tax thresholds, that runs out or stops in 4 years' time. You're going to be working on a five-year budgeting horizon. Would you extend it by another year?
The point of the budget is that you can consider all of these things in the round. Some of it will be based on the latest forecasts for economic activity, household incomes, and also the public finances. You know, Adam, that we face a situation where there's a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. So there are difficult decisions to come on tax and welfare and spending. But as I set out in the conference speech today, if we can get a grip of the public finances, return stability to our economy, combine that with the reform that we are making to unlock private investment in our economy, I am confident that the prize at the end of that is economic growth. And with economic growth comes more money in the pockets of working people, better jobs in all of our communities, and money for our public services without increasing taxes, because the tax receipts come in from a growing economy.
Last question. The great thing about conferences is the people you bump into. And I was walking past here about an hour ago, and I saw Andy Serkis, the actor who played Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And I was like, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, I'm lobbying for a tax credit for visual effects that Jeremy Hunt was going to extend, but that which they ran out of time to do. And he said, ask Rachel Reeves if she's going to help the visual effects industry.
Well, so I haven't met Gollum
yet. Wants to know.
Well, I look forward to meeting Gollum and many other of our delegates and visitors here at conference. You're right. Conference is a great opportunity to meet old friends. I've been coming to Labour Party conference since 1997 was my first one. And of course, that was the first conference when we had a Labour government after 18 years. And I remember being in that hall listening to Tony Blair and to Gordon Brown as Chancellor. And to be here today as the first Labour Chancellor in 14 years and the first female Chancellor of the Exchequer, sometimes I have to pinch myself to know that it's real. It's an amazing opportunity, a huge privilege for me, and I intend to repay the trust that people have put in me.
And presumably now you've done the big speech, you can go and have some drinks and go to the parties.
Well, today
are you doing that anyway?
You obviously don't know me very well, Adam. But today is business day at conference, and so I'll be spending time with some of the business representatives from businesses big and small, sending that message loud and clear. With this Labour government, Britain is open for business. We want investment. We want wealth creation here in the UK, and the jobs, the prosperity that comes along with that.
Chancellor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam.
So my main takeaways from Rachel Reeves in that conversation I had with her, one, she's obviously just totally stoked to sound Australian about being the first female chancellor, obviously. She was raging about that protester There was no like, oh, freedom of speech, right to protest. She was actually, I think, pretty annoyed that her big moment.
I think you could kind of tell that from the stage as well.
Was partially ruined.
Do you remember, actually, do you remember last year when Keir Starmer had the guy with the glitter who poured glitter all over Keir Starmer? Yeah. And there was that shot on camera of Rachel Reeves saying, oh, for God's sake.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
That's right.
She does not like interruptions.
And they also have that standard line, don't they? Because her form of words was very similar to his of a year ago about we're no longer a party of protest, you know, that kind of, that kind of stuff. Trying to make a turn a positive for an interruption.
And in terms of kind of news-ish things, because I did say she's good at sticking to her scripts, news-ish things, that rumour that they were thinking about axing the single person's council tax discount, she went as far as she could to say, to getting to say that that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Now that's interesting because there was also a briefing about this to journalists from Number 10 because it was reported last night that they're not going to do that because this idea has really gained some traction in light of the winter fuel payment cut. So there was a story last night about this suggesting that it's not going to happen in the budget and Number 10 today suggested that that was pretty accurate. So I think that's now the settled line because before they hadn't ruled it in or out as they often do with budget stuff, to be fair, but it seems they're steering pretty firmly away.
Yeah, it's interesting this. And I don't know how this came out when you were on your trip to Rome last week, but when I was on the trip to Washington the week before and we did the little huddle thing with the Prime Minister and we were kicking around as a collection of journalists a whole load of questions about what might be in the budget and the whole mantra, the kind of journalistic formulation of refuse to rule out. The Prime Minister, I might have talked about this on Newscast about a week ago, so excuse me if I'm repeating myself, but the Prime Minister did this whole riff about, I know the game. You know, you put X to me, I can't rule it out because there's a budget coming up and I'm not going to confirm anything outside of a fiscal event, as they call it. And then you write a headline that says the Prime Minister or Chancellor hasn't ruled out ... Now, that's not quite true because there are various things they do choose to rule out in advance.
Bus passes, they've been
quite exactly, clear on. Exactly. And so, but this
one... Yeah, they play the game too.
Well, yeah, completely. And there are certain things that you might wait until the budget for, but, I mean, ultimately, they choose what they announce and when they announce it. But this one, I think that they had concluded that hair had run for too long. And so deciding to pretty much shut it down. Not even pretty much. They have shut it down.
Yeah. And then the other thing that shone through in that interview is just loosening the purse strings a little bit. Now, this means we've got a slight bit of kind of investment hokey-cokey, because remember Rachel Reeves' initial position was that huge big green prosperity fund, $28 billion of investment per year in green energy and insulation, and then that got whittled down to almost nothing. Now it looks like she's sort of whittling it back up a bit, and the way she's doing that is by sounding a little bit more relaxed about what her actual fiscal rules will be. Although, again, very difficult to pin her down on what she actually means by that.
But it might just mean, and chancellors of all colours like to do this if they can, is you surprise on the upside, as many people might conclude it to look, when you get to your budget.
You mean she finds some money down the back of the sofa
exactly.
And then says, oh, hey presto, things aren't as bad, I can invest in some more railway lines.
But it was quite interesting in her speech that she did make a point of saying that she wanted the Treasury to start to see the benefit of investment. You know, they wanted to be a mind shift about this, that investment always isn't just always a cost. You know, it can actually generate income, come with a saving. And she made a point of suggesting she was. And of course, those fiscal rules that we talk about, which effectively means that she wants to get debt falling, and so she limits how much she can borrow, which also self-imposed, let's be clear, it's a choice that she's made to follow pretty much the same rules that the last government had as well.
Although we had a bit of a back and forward about that in our conversation, and she was really emphasizing the first fiscal rule, which is the thing she really wants to balance, is current spending.
So like, don't borrow for day-to-day.
The day-to-day bills.
Even interesting.
She was really not emphasizing the second half, which is
that's
the
fascinating in its own right, because if there is going to be a shift, everyone that I've spoken to suggests it will be about the second bit, which is about borrowing to invest. Does she loosen there somewhere? Because there's definitely a train of thought, and at this conference you do pick it up. People say if the government wants to achieve which one of its kind of central ambitions, which is to get the economy growing, the way to do it is to invest.
And do it early.
And obviously, I definitely haven't had any clear steers on this, to be absolutely transparent about the whole thing. But, you know, there was definitely language around it today in the speech, and interesting that in your conversation with her.
Although, again, the problem is, I'm thinking back to that paper that was published by the Office for Budget Responsibility a few weeks ago. Do you remember all the nerds? We're like, and it's about how the economy works, and like the government investing can have quite a big payback. in 50 years' time.
Yeah.
Like, it takes a long time.
And she has to marry that with what we were talking about earlier, is that she wants to be seen as the Chancellor that's responsible with the public funds. And she's really, really hammered that. I mean, that's... And she did it in a speech again today.
Yeah.
She really hammered that. You can trust Labour with your money, and, is the message
and
she's
cultivated. Arguably Labour have to overdo that kind of stuff because of that kind of sense. And it's a perception they are aware of themselves, from many, of Labour governments, perhaps, or the Labour Party more broadly, often being perceived to be a bit shaky on economic competence.
And also on the thing about the nurses' pay, I think she's been helped a bit by what the Royal College of Nursing actually did today. They voted to reject a pay offer, which they're still accepting. So it's not, they didn't vote to reopen negotiations or any kind of negotiations with the government to lead to a higher pay offer this year. So that minimizes that disruption. And the other place where the disruption is minimizes, today they weren't voting to have more strikes.
No.
So actually it was just it was literally some saber rattling about pay
and
rather than actually doing
anything.
I
interviewed the General Secretary of the Royal College of Nursing just not so long ago, Professor Nicola Ranger, and because the timing was interesting, wasn't it? Rachel Reeves was on her feet saying we've given the public sector a pay rise and, you know, talking about ending all the strikes. And then the phone started pinging and it was RCN votes to reject the 5.5%.
Yeah, and she didn't know in advance that was going
to
happen.
Well, and actually, you know, the General Secretary of the Union was very clear to me that the timing was pure coincidence and not design. I put it to her and she said, the government were also aware that the vote was coming, the result of the vote was coming today. So, you know, there's all that as well.
And then... striking, not surprising, but worth pointing out, I think, that the framing of Rachel Reeves's argument about those public sector pay deals was, yes, nodding to the fact that the argument being that after years of not getting a pay rise, they have had a pay rise, but framing it around those who benefit from it, i.e. punters on trains and people going to hospital.
Yeah.
In other words, framing it as a consumer thing rather than a producer thing, given that what might be a prejudice from some might be a sense that Labour would seek to look after those on the kind of producer side, if like the trade unionists, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
So Keir Starmer's speech is on Tuesday afternoon. Chris, you said you'll watch the speech, then get on a plane to America.
Pretty much. We'll rapidly assemble a piece for the 6 o'clock news, first. And then dash to Liverpool Airport, fly to New York, and then we'll do what is normally our interviews with the party leader.
Which would normally be in a hotel here.
Exactly. We'll be at somewhere in New York.
Okay.
And then he's going to do his thing at the UN General Assembly where New York will be completely kind of gridlocked with motorcades everywhere, world leaders from everywhere turning up. Lots of conversations, no doubt, on that whole business of missiles in Ukraine and can they be fired into Russia, etc.
And given the escalating tensions in the Middle East, no doubt
that's
going to feature very prominently.
Well. And that as well.
So if you're not going to be sitting here on Tuesday night telling us what Keir Starmer said, would you like to review his speech in advance now?
Oh, that's brave.
Christopher Nolan time jump?
I'm interested to hear this.
What a question.
I was just trying to be smart and be like, do a preview of what it's going to be like any thoughts they might be having about how he's going
to
do it.
Well, yeah, to be clear, I've not yet had any formal briefing about what we might expect. That will probably happen this evening, or maybe it has happened and I've missed it.
You were with us instead.
Yeah, and I need to make some phone calls. So this has not come as a result of any of the briefing that tends to happen in advance of these things, where people like me try and say, well, I expect he might say X, and then he says X. I think it'll build on where we've been today. So I think there'll be that sense of trying to sound a bit more optimistic, whilst acknowledging, and no doubt because this happens in partisan party conferences, they'll do a load of blaming of the Conservatives, which is what Rachel Reeves did. I think he will do, because leaders always do this, and particularly when you're standing in front of your party faithful for the first time as Prime Minister, there'll be all of their, look what you guys have done, talking to the hall, as well as talking to the country. I guess trying to sketch out something of the kind of 5-year vision. But remember, Keir Starmer talks about a 10-year vision.
Yeah.
He talks about this decade of national renewal, quote unquote. So I think there'll be a fair smattering of that. And yeah, who knows what else?
I just wonder, with this slogan, "Change Begins," all Labour slogans are going to be based on Batman film titles now.
It's like a thing.
It's going to be like "Change Rises," "Change and Robin."
Change ends.
Change ends. Oh, I don't think they want to do that one.
No.
Anyway, right, newscast ends, though. Chris, safe travels.
Thank you.
Except even though we've got a whole, like, private conference speech in between.
There's another day yet.
So, yeah, tomorrow in the newscast timeline, you're off.
Yeah, no, I suppose so. I could send you a little voice note.
Oh, that's a good
idea. You've got space for it.
Wi-Fi on the plane and all that.
Yeah, or even before I get on the plane. Yeah.
Right, Chris, options I'll see you endless. Later. Alex, I'll see you right back here, probably the same time on Tuesday.
Same time tomorrow.
And there'll be another BBC Sounds podcast about the same time tomorrow. So the time now, though, is 4:43.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. The Prime Minister will warn of a shared struggle ahead, but say that there is light at the end of the tunnel in a key speech to Labour Party delegates today. In his first address at conference since taking office, Sir Keir Starmer will say tough decisions need to be taken to build a new Britain. People in southern Lebanon have been fleeing their homes after extensive Israeli airstrikes. The Lebanese health ministry said that nearly 500 people had been killed in cross-border fire. The Israeli military said that it had hit around 1,300 Hezbollah targets. A ban on zombie-style knives and machetes has come into force in England and Wales. A four-week amnesty, which allowed people to hand in knives to the police without prosecution, has ended. It's now illegal to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives, often used by criminal gangs. Five Live Sport now has Shabnam Yunus Jewell.
Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's 3 defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team. The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been moved to St James's Park next Tuesday after the London club's stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Records Stadium on Tuesday night. 4 games are still on. 5 Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Leeds United have announced plans to modernise and improve Elland Road. Part of the proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. The League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs. And on 5 Sports Extra on Tuesday from 12:15, you can hear England against Australia in the third One Day International. England are 2-0 down in the series heading into that match at Chesterley Street.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK. On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello. Well, we saw some severe flooding and disruption yesterday, particularly focused on the South Midlands. Oxfordshire hit especially hard, and it was here where we had nearly 100 millimetres rain, about a month and a half's worth of rainfall in the space of a day. That's causing the damage. Now, looking at the weather picture today, it's a much calmer kind of day. OK, there's a few dribs and drabs of light patches of rain left over across East Anglia and South East England to start off with, but that's going to clear out of the way. Quite a lot of cloud, a few mist and fog patches around first thing in the morning, but I think as we go on through the morning, most of England and Wales will see sunny spells break through. In the afternoon, just a few showers coming into the northwest of both England and Wales. Most, though, should have a dry day. In Northern Ireland, it's a day of sunny spells and showers. And finally, the forecast for Scotland. Here we've got a cold front pushing southwards, bringing a spell of rain, followed by showers into the afternoon across northern areas. That cold front really dropping the temperatures. So for most of the UK, 14 to 18 degrees your top temperature, but for northern Scotland, just 10 degrees. And the colder weather will spread to the rest of Scotland and Northern Ireland for tomorrow. Chris Fawkes, 5 Live Weather.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense 6-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Dotun Adebayo. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, and it's time to look at the headlines that you're waking up to this morning. I've been going through the front pages with freelance journalist Carol Mahon.
So I'm looking at the Metro, so e-bike crime boom. And this is a piece on how police are seizing up to 83% more of e-bikes, mainly in the city of London, it's been recorded. And this is because of, so basically electric bikes that are not basically permitted under UK law. So they're being fitted with sort of motors that are exceeding the speed limit. And it's basically becoming a bit of a problem for sort of pedestrians, even people on the roads. You often see it on sort of social media, then whizzing through crowds. And so this is the first real crackdown we're seeing on this sort of new type of crime.
Interesting that it's a crime about the speed, readjusting, if you like, the e-bikes to break UK speed limits, rather than a crime about, you know, what I thought from the headline, e-bike crime boom. I thought it was people stealing e-bikes.
Yeah, it does give off that impression, doesn't it? And that's also a major aspect of it as well. I'm sure as you get into the article, that would probably reveal itself, that a lot of people that are sort of involved in sort of crimes around major cities, we've all seen the phone snatching videos, particularly in London as well. They're often on these illegal e-bikes, so they can get away at really fast speeds without anyone really catching up to them.
It's also, isn't it, interesting that the police have finally got round to sort of tackling this problem, because many of our listeners will know, not just e-bikes, but scooters as well, go way beyond the limit that they're supposed to go at. You know, I've seen scooters go at limits where I would only wear a crash helmet on a motorcycle to go at that speed.
These are all sort of illegal sort of forms of transportation that are being fitted out themselves by people. You can buy these motors online, and you can buy them and fit them on sort of your e-scooters and e-bikes for sure. The general e-scooters we see around town, obviously those will tend to be provided by sort of local government authorities, so we can kind of rest assured that those are all within sort of the speed limit. But it's the first major crackdown we're seeing, and it's good to see. This is sort of, I guess you could say, a new type of crime, like you said, a crime boom that we haven't really seen before. So this is just the police now playing catch up to hopefully a problem that will be stamped out.
And this is your top story rather than the Labour Party conference in Liverpool?
For everyday people. These are sort of the crimes that I guess people want to know about on their sort of doorstep, you know. This is something that affects everyday people in cities.
Well, in that case, let's drink to Lily the pink, the saviour of the human race, for she invented medicinal compound. That's what I'm saying, because it's time to call time on pints. Is it in The Guardian?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so this is in The Guardian, specifically in this supplement G2. And from what I can gather, it's a piece on, Are we finally seeing an end to sort of what we know as a rampant drinking culture in this country? Anyone that's sort of been brought up in the UK can definitely vouch for that, that there's a huge drinking culture here. There's certainly an after work drinking culture. And it's basically exploring, are we finally seeing an end to this? Could it be for health reasons? Could it be for a sort of lifestyle, cost of living? There's many avenues to explore, but are we seeing the end of sort of the after work drink up, basically?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask. Is it the end of the after work drinker, or is it more the demise of pubs? Because I think it was just yesterday there was a figure saying that 50 pubs a month are closing across the UK. But then arguably it's which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Good point, to be honest. Really good point. Obviously that's not really made clear in that headline whether it's the pub, but again, pub culture is a massive part of, you know, British drinking culture. It's only sort of recently, I guess, we've moved out of, you know, meeting up for a pint after work at the local pub, you know. So again, it's a fair point you're making. But what is Britain without all drinking culture? I don't know where that would steer us as a society, as a people.
There's a story in The Mirror as well, which sees a victory for truth and justice.
So this looks at Keir Starmer pledging sort of to fully sort of pass legislation on the Hillsborough law. So I heard about this law many, many years ago, and it looks now it's starting to really pick up momentum off the back of Grenfell and the back of the infected blood scandal. Hillsborough law basically looks to stop state cover-ups denying victims justice. We all know about sort of Hillsborough disaster and the people that died in that and how that was handled by the police and the government afterwards. And we're now seeing a sort of this playing out again in real time with Grenfell and the lives lost that were lost in that. So Keir Starmer, after issuing a state apology, is now saying that this law looks like it's very much likely going to be legislated and will include aid, take on officials and recruiting a public advocate to stop people being ignored by the state. So it's a very, very powerful law. Some will say massively overdue.
Yeah, I can see some challenges, though, because unless he legislates how, you know, the definition of state cover-up might be, because the state covers up in so many different ways. Mm. You know, you may not find that the public trying to take the state to court is not such an easy prospect, unless you legislate and say, for example, if there are, you know, 500 members or 1,000 members of the public that are directly or indirectly affected by whatever it is that the state's been accused of covering up, and, you know, that makes, that gives the legislative arm a strong base to begin with, at least. Do you see, Keir Starmer, on the one hand, he's a football fan, so I'm minded to sort of think, oh, right, this is pushing this through because he knows actually what Hillsborough means. And on the other hand, he is a lawyer, a top barrister, and you're thinking, well, surely you know that it needs one little bit of legislation to make it viable. And I'm not sure we got there yet. Are you?
I mean, I think this is a big step. Like I said, I've heard of this law floating around, and since he's been in power, this is the most I've ever heard of it sort of mentioned in the last few years, to be honest. We certainly didn't see this mentioned in the Conservative government. So I think I don't think we can doubt him just yet. I think he's moving in the right direction. You know, he's offered a state apology, something we don't often see, off the back of the Grenfell inquiry report that came out only a few weeks ago. So I think he's instilling a lot of faith in people that have sort of dealt with this injustice, and like you said, making it a lot easier for your average Joe to take on the state, you know, which is obviously a very, very hard thing to do, because we all know that cover-ups do happen. And I think this is giving a chance for sort of people to have their voices heard. It's long overdue, and I definitely feel I can understand that. It almost feels like an injustice in itself, even though it's come around now. I would imagine it feels a bit like, oh God, yeah, finally, here we go again. But, you know, it's better than not having it, is it?
Yeah, Karen Mahon, there with the headlines. And that's about it from us. Thank you for listening. Thanks to the squad. Of course, thanks to Alex and Solmaz in the studio. And thanks to Judy, who edited the programme. Judy and Aaron, who produced it. So, Wake Up to Money is next. In the World Football Phone-In, we were deciding on a Brazilian shirt name for Zoe from Northampton, because she's from Northampton. It had to be Shuey Gallagher. As the Reverend Richard Coles is also from Northampton, we thought we'd end on something from his old band, the Communards. Do you remember? Don't Leave Me This Way. It wasn't an original, but a decent cover, wouldn't you say?
the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Sir Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of the tunnel as he addresses his first Labour conference as Prime Minister. But he will warn of a shared struggle through short-term pressures. In his speech, he will talk about a goal of creating a Britain built to last. Our political correspondent Ian Watson is at the conference in Liverpool. He says Sir Keir will set out a vision for the country.
There'll be a smattering of specific policies around skills, for example, and more he'll be saying on welfare reform, because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere. But we'll get a little bit more of that detail. And I think there was a worry that here's a party with a big majority, and yet there's a bit of a cloud hanging over the conference, people feeling a little bit gloomy and worried indeed that businesses and others might feel gloomy and not give the country the investment and growth that it needs.
Thousands of families have been fleeing their homes in Lebanon after authorities say almost 500 people were killed yesterday in Israeli airstrikes. Israel says it killed a number of Hezbollah fighters and hit around 13,000 targets. The White House says President Biden will present concrete plans for ending the crisis in Lebanon at the UN General Assembly in New York this week. These people in Beirut are very worried.
The thing that's happening is far away from humanity, and this shouldn't be happening.
If a total war happens, we should stand as Lebanese people together, regardless of our political affiliations, because at the end of the day, our country is getting bombed.
Zombie-style knives and machetes are banned in England and Wales from today as a new law comes into force. It's now illegal to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives, often used by criminal gangs. A consumer group is calling for a public inquiry into the collapse of the funeral company Safe Hands Plans Limited. Almost 50,000 people lost their money they paid into a funeral plan when the company went bust in 2022. At the time, the industry was unregulated, but funeral providers are now required the approval of the Financial Conduct Authority to operate. Margaret and David Fee